Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point.
They want it. We think it's important. And I think we would be making a big mistake if we didn't have it.
The North Korea summit, back on for now. Rudy Giuliani makes the rounds and says the president can pardon himself. President Trump agrees. Tough talk on trade and tariffs from the U.S.'s usually polite northern neighbor just days before Canada hosts the G7. Congress gets back to work. Also this week, a big primary day. Votes in California, the Deep South, and the Midwest. This hour on Point, top reporters open their notebooks and look ahead to the week in Washington. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of Giuliani and Trump talking about self-pardons? And on the 500th day of mark of the Trump presidency, how do you score it? Join us at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. A great panel this hour. Joining me from Washington, Eliana Johnson, White House reporter for Politico. Eliana, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
With me also from Washington, Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics. Sahil, welcome back to you. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Good to be back.
And finally, joining me from Washington as well, Ishan Tharoor, foreign affairs writer for The Washington Post. Ishan, great to have you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
So we'll start with this 500-day mark in his presidency, which President Trump has now hit. Jonathan Swan of Axios writes, quote, "Everything has changed and nothing has changed." Eliana, we'll start with you. Is he right? Your thoughts to kick off our conversation.
Oh, I think a lot has changed during the Trump presidency. What I look to most of all is that I think Trump has done away with a lot of presidential norms. And that, I think, may be the most lasting impact of his president, because it's not clear that future presidents will revert to these norms. He doesn't talk like a president, like previous presidents we've known, Republican or Democrat, who have govern themselves by these norms. He doesn't behave like previous presidents. His use of Twitter is a good example of that. And I think that may be the most lasting impact of his presidency policy aside. So we're only a year and a half in. We don't know really what the lasting policy impacts will be. Takes a long time to assess that.
Sahil Kapoor, Trump supporters would point you to Gallup polling data, which shows President Trump has the second highest approval rating within his own party since World War II, 87%, only behind George W. Bush. That puts him in par with George H.W. Bush, pre-Gulf War, and JFK and Eisenhower. I mean, by that measure, this is a successful presidency, isn't it, Sahil?
By the standard that his own party supports him, that's absolutely true. I think the president has a very high level of support among Republican voters. It hovers between 80 and 90% in most polls. That says most of these Republicans have a very low opinion of their own representatives in Congress. But the president has changed the party in very, very significant ways, and I think that's one of the biggest legacies of his first 500 days. As well as the campaign, he's moved it in a more protectionist direction in terms of trade. He's moved it in a more nativist and anti-immigration direction. Culturally, I think he's inflamed a lot of culture wars that previous presidents, would have at least thought twice before doing. I don't think he does. So the real history of these 500 days is going to be written, I think, after the midterm elections are done, when the country gets to cast its first referendum on, do we support this? Do we want to continue moving forward with this and validate everything the president has done? Or do we want to throw his party out of office and, make a statement that the country should not tolerate this, this way of being president?
On this 500-day mark for the Trump presidency, James is in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Hi, James. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Yeah, I would like to first and foremost state that President Trump is doing a fantastic job to stand by his what he did on his campaign trail to actually do what he says. And that being said, he's the first president that I've known to ever complete his process on the campaign trail.
He's doing what he said he'd do, James. Thank you. Ishan Tharoor, jump in here. There's James saying, well, you know, he kept his promises, and we do have those promises. Exiting the Paris climate deal, the TPP, the Iran deal, signing tax cuts, put a conservative justice in the Supreme Court, repealed the ACA's individual mandate. We've got new hardline immigration enforcement in place. That is quite a list of accomplishments.
Well, yes, exactly. If by accomplishments we mean satisfying the goals that he set out for his own base, sure. The top line, though, from a global perspective, is that these 500 days have marked a kind of rolling story of uncertainty and chaos. And as yes, Trump has rather successfully played the role of a global disruptor, as you said. He's exited the Paris Agreement a year ago. More recently, he scuppered the Iran deal, a huge feat of multilateral diplomacy by the previous administration. And of course, now he's in the midst of this new protectionist push against even a host of allies. But it still remains profoundly unclear strategically what any of this has gained, what the United States gains from any of this. And beyond, of course, as our caller phoned in, satisfying a certain segment of his support. And at the same time, what we do know is that a whole host of the U.S.'s traditional allies now see in the White House and someone who is an unreliable, destabilizing, perhaps even hostile actor to their interests. And that takes us into a fascinating new geopolitical moment. Mm.
James, thank you very much for the call. Eliana Johnson, let me ask you about this big story in the New York Times on Saturday. President Trump's lawyers sending special counsel Robert Mueller a 20-page letter making broad claims of executive power. Here he is, Rudy Giuliani, on ABC's This Week, the president's attorney, saying that he agreed with the assertions contained in that letter that contends the president cannot illegally obstruct the Russia investigation because the Constitution gives him power to terminate the inquiry.
Well, they're excellent. Yeah, as a legal arguments, I didn't see it at the time. Obviously, I wouldn't have been allowed to, but I know the argument, and it's very, very persuasive.
Eliana, what about that? What about that assertion of executive power?
Yeah, the argument that Giuliani is making and that the letter made is that the Justice Department is subordinate to the president, and the president has the right at any point, and for whatever reason, it doesn't matter what his mindset is, to fire the FBI director, to terminate any investigation that the Justice Department has going, including the Mueller probe, and for whatever reason, because they report to the president. They're not a separate branch of government. And what Giuliani said, and I think this is very important, is that the American public, as a result, has the right to find those reasons and to find his actions objectionable. And so while the president can't be tried in a court of law for obstruction of justice or for any of these actions, he can be impeached. And Giuliani mentioned that word several times, which I think is important. He said impeachment is the proper resolution for any actions the president might take. And he said, yes, while the president has the right to pardon himself, he really shouldn't do that because he'd be impeached. And I considered that a message to Trump as much as it was a legal argument.
Here he is, Rudy Giuliani, again on ABC's This Week, talking about the president's pardon power this time.
Do you and the president's attorneys believe the president has the power to pardon himself?
He's not, but he probably does. I mean, he has no intention of pardoning himself, but he probably does. It doesn't say he can't. I mean, that's another really interesting constitutional argument. Can the president pardon himself?
It is an interesting question, Sahil Kapoor. What do you say? The president tweeted this morning on this point, I have the absolute right to pardon myself. But why would I do that when I have done nothing wrong? Sahil, what about it?
This is one of those legal questions that's kind of novel in the Trump era because no president has seriously thought to do this in the past. And, you know, the last time we faced a situation where a president was under investigation, on the verge of being indicted for some serious wrongdoings was Richard Nixon, and he ended up resigning. So, yes, there's always been a political cost, to being, I guess, being in the public eye in such a negative way. And I think the president, President Trump, is taking it in a different direction, asserting very broad presidential powers. One of the things that was notable, I think, in the New York Times piece was that it was the first time we learned that the president's legal team has admitted he dictated his son's response about the meeting with Russians, the Trump Tower meeting with Russians promising dirt on Hillary Clinton. Their stories changed a number of times. Rudy Giuliani remarkably said on the Sunday shows, the Trump team's recollection keeps changing, quote unquote.
One of our listeners, Sebastian, writes on this point, the thrust of Rudy Giuliani's argument is that he is not above the law. He was simply acknowledging the DOJ's policy that it's not to indict a sitting president. The policy would be to impeach first and then indict. Ileana, isn't that correct?
I think that's right. You know, there are some people who argue otherwise, but Giuliani was arguing that these are political questions first before they're legal questions. And so he said that once the president is out of office because he's been impeached or because his term ended, then Robert Mueller is free to prosecute the president for any crimes he may have committed. But he said Robert Mueller cannot prosecute the president while he was in office. And so I think what you're hearing from Democrats that, no, this isn't true, you hear them saying the president is not above the law. Mm-hmm. That is true, but he cannot be prosecuted while he's in office.
And Sahil, how is Congress reacting to all of this?
I wouldn't expect Congress to attempt to do much at this point. The midterm elections are coming up. Democrats have recognized that this whole issue of the president being investigated and the Russia probe is not politically beneficial to them. People have kind of moved into their corners, and the White House and the president, their actions here should be viewed more as a PR strategy and less as a legal strategy. It is about moving Republican voters against the investigation. It's about bringing them to his side and making them believe this whole thing is ginned up and as he calls it, a witch hunt. So, Kevin McCarthy, the House Majority Leader, the probable next speaker, was on the Sunday shows yesterday on CNN, and he was asked about, the White House lying about the president's knowledge. He was asked about the president asserting the right to pardon himself. He didn't really sound bothered by any of it, and that's an indication that the Republicans in Congress who run Congress are behind the president.
30 seconds before we go to break here, Ishan, it's worth noting that Rudy Giuliani in another interview said President Trump could have shot James Comey and still not be indicted for it. Your sense of all this and the reaction from foreign leaders as they watch this unfold?
Well, the ambassadors and diplomats that you speak to here in D.C. tend to steer clear from discussing any of these kind of domestic issues. But at the same time, they do point out that the cynicism and some apparent venality of this administration when it comes to the messaging around this is familiar in countries with less robust traditions of democracy.
Well, we're discussing the week ahead in Washington and around the world, and you can join the conversation. What now? After China's and Canada's tough talk over the weekend on trade tariffs. Are you ready to book your ticket to Singapore for the North Korea summit? I'm Jane Clayson. More after this break, including your calls. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're looking at the week ahead with a panel of top reporters this hour, and you can join the conversation. What's ahead for President Trump at the G7 with all the hot talk over tariffs? What are you hoping Congress will tackle when they get back to work? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Great panel this hour. I'm speaking with Ishan Tharoor of The Washington Post, Ileana Johnson of Politico, and Sahil Kapoor of Bloomberg Politics. I've got so many calls. I want to get a few in here before we move on. Moore is in Dawson, Alabama. Hi, Moore.
Hello, Jen.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
Yes.
What do you have to say, Moore? What's on your mind?
Oh, what's on my mind is that I just think that the investigation of Trump has gone long enough.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, they should either bring up the charge and convict him or let the man run the country. I think it's the longer this goes, the more Americans become divided.
Make your move or move on. Moore, thank you very much. I'm glad to hear your perspective on that. And Barbara's in Albuquerque, New Mexico, with another thought. Hi, Barbara. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I guess my concern is that in the last year, a great deal has been accomplished, but I fear what's been accomplished is to somehow drive us back to the level of a banana republic where self-gain and lies are what seems to make advances, and that somehow people have been convinced that this is progress. And I don't think until farther down the road we're going to start feeling the impact of what's being done to science, what's being done to healthcare, what the long-lasting effect of the judiciary and the real undermining of any kind of confidence in governmental systems. And it's all based on lies, whether it's the number, the party affiliation of investigators or what existing immigration law is.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like we're being plunged back into a time where any of that is acceptable because all of a sudden people feel like they have the right to use the N-word in public.
I hear you. We're moving backwards in many ways, Barbara, is your perspective. Thank you. Let's get Tom. He's got another point of view from Newark, New Jersey. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I have to disagree with most of the callers, actually. I do believe that President Trump has an amazing job to date. When it comes to donating his entire salary to organizations like that help veterans and public transportation, for instance, his last donation, and other things, that the lowest unemployment ever, and lots of things that the mainstream media is not covering so far, and I just give him all credit for that. That's all I have to say.
Good, Tom. Thank you very much for the call. Two very different perspectives there. Let's take that and run with the issue of tariffs and trade. The U.S. and China ended trade talks in Beijing on Sunday. A lot of tough talk and not much else. Here is William Zaret, the president of the American Chamber of Commerce in China, telling NPR's Morning Edition earlier today that he's not sure why officials from the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, or USTR, were not present at this weekend's trade talks with China.
It was disappointing because I think that the USTR has really the best handle on this negotiation. So next time, I'm hoping that USTR will play a bigger role in talks.
Sean Tharoor, any idea why they weren't there this time?
I, to be honest, I don't know specifically in this case. We do know that Robert Lighthizer, the U.S. Trade Representative, is a rather ideological figure, somebody who has a real bone to pick with the World Trade Organization and other kind of linchpins of the existing international order when it comes to trade issues. And this administration has been jockeying on multiple fronts, and that's perhaps part of this absence.
During the talks with China, the U.S. seemed to be very focused on this notion that China should just buy more American stuff, and that would narrow the trade deficit. China, of course, is no way unless the U.S. agrees not to impose further tariffs on Chinese products, Ishan. I mean, are we at an impasse here? Are we closer to a trade war than we were before these talks, or is a trade war possibly already underway?
I think we're getting closer now. There is a clear sense that, and especially Chinese more so than the Europeans, can do real damage to the American economy with the, especially the agricultural sector, by levying their own retaliatory tariffs. And this impasse, it's not encouraging for those who fear that these negotiations are just destined to fail.
Mm. Here is Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday about how his country would respond to a new trade tariff if the U.S. levied against its northern neighbor.
We're putting the same kinds of tariffs exactly on steel and aluminum coming from the United States into Canada to be directly reciprocal. But we're also putting a number of tariffs on consumer goods, finished products for which Canadians have easy alternatives.
And here's White House Chief Economic Advisor Larry Kudlow dismissing the Canadian Prime Minister and his criticisms of U.S. tariffs, telling Fox News on Sunday that Trudeau was simply overreacting.
We still welcome good faith negotiations, and that's why I regard this as more of a family quarrel. This is a trade dispute, if you will. It can be solved if people work together. But I must say this president from day one wants to reform the world trading system. It is not working. And there is so much unfair trading and illegal trading practices. There is virtually no reciprocity here.
So, Eliana Johnson, a family quarrel. There's the White House chief economic advisor talking about our issues with Canada. I mean, China's one thing, but what kind of fallout could we see from our neighbor to the north on this?
Right. I think you've heard lawmakers on both sides of the aisle say, let's put China to one side, and nobody seems to have a problem dealing in a tough way with China, who has violated all sorts of trade norms. But they really do have a problem with imposing tariffs on our allies, many of whom we need to do to deal with us cooperatively on other foreign policy matters. And it may be a family quarrel, I think, from Larry Kudlow's perspective or from the president's perspective. But when you hear Justin Trudeau talk about this, he seemed offended in a sort of personal way. He said on NBC News yesterday that, you know, in order to impose these tariffs, the U.S. had to say that Canada poses a national security risk to the United States. And Trudeau cited that and said, you know, Canada has fought side by side in the U.S. In many wars, World War I, World War II, and he said that he found it inconceivable that this could be true and really pushed back in a strong way on sort of the ideological basis for these tariffs. So it doesn't seem to me that Canada is viewing it that way, though certainly Trudeau said he was hoping for a resolution.
This morning, President Trump tweeted, China already charges a tax of 16% on soybeans. Canada has all sorts of trade barriers on our agricultural products. Not acceptable, the president tweeted. In another one, he says, when we're almost $800 billion a year down on trade, you cannot lose a trade war. Ray on Facebook writes to us, calling it a trade war with our allies is disingenuous and dishonest. Speaking here of Canada, of course. The trade war is with our competitors. Ford and GM don't see Toyota and Volkswagen as allies. They see them as competition. Bad trade deals were made by previous administrations. It's time that these bad trade deals are renegotiated. Sahil, jump in here. How do you see this, and how do our congressional leaders see this move? These moves by President Trump.
I mean, this is the dictionary definition of a trade war. Now, the president and his allies can argue that it was started by you know, our competitors like Mexico and Canada, allies. Perhaps, and especially more so in the case of China, that they're the ones engaging in unfair trade practices, which I think many would agree with. But this is absolutely what a trade war looks like: tariffs, threats of retaliation, further tariffs. Mexico is already talking about retaliating, you know, in addition to Canada, by putting new levies on pork bellies, grapes, apples. This is going to hit farmers in the United States pretty badly, and a lot of these states strongly, you know, support President Trump. I think this is where the rubber hits the road. Are these farmers, and you know, various Trump constituencies who now face the higher costs of goods at home as a result of these tariffs going to be okay with that trade-off in exchange for protecting domestic industries? That's one point. And as far as Congress goes, I would not expect Congress to do anything. We'll hear a lot of talk and probably no action. Among Democrats, we'll hear a mix of support and opposition, support from progressives like Sherrod Brown in Ohio, who's you know, in favor of these tariffs, opposition from many others, including Democratic leaders. From Republicans, I think there's a desire not to offend the president. They know where the base is on this. They know the base is behind President Trump for the most part, and they also know that it takes a two-thirds majority to override a presidential veto on a resolution of disapproval. So I don't see this going anywhere in Congress.
Let's go to Derek in Vermilion, South Dakota. Hi, Derek. I'm glad you called.
Hi, Jane. I just have a quick point to make.
Okay.
It seems to me that entering into the trade wars and tariffs simply shifts wealth around. It doesn't really solve the problem. So from my perspective, I think that we would be far ahead to get back to the negotiating table and to drop all of this trade war tariff stuff.
Derek, thank you. Ishan Thapur, you wrote on Friday that a trade war is deepening the West's sense of crisis. What else do you anticipate from Europe on this point?
Well, like Canada and Mexico, the Europeans are planning significant retaliatory measures. They're like Justin Trudeau, European leaders were shocked to be deemed national security threats to the United States, which is how Trump could even enact these measures in the first place. And we're also seeing that it's not just that wealth gets shifted around. It's that there's a sense that the trade war will hurt all sides. It will, you know, hurt growth. And forget, you know, we talked about the auto industry and helping Ford and other companies, but their real fear is that these steel tariffs would impact the auto manufacturing industry by tens of thousands of jobs. So there's a sense that this is not really solving the economic problems that the president thinks it is.
Well, from trade and tariffs to North Korea now, the North Korea summit appears to be back on. President Trump told reporters on Friday that the summit between him and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is a go, but he tempered expectations for next week's meeting.
June 12th, we'll be in Singapore. It'll be a beginning, I don't say, and I've never said it happens in one meeting. You're talking about years of hostility, years of problems, years of really hatred between so many different nations. But I think you're going to have a very positive result.
And here is U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis telling reporters in Singapore just yesterday that he anticipates a bumpy road to the negotiations between the U.S. and North Korea.
We will continue to implement all U.N. Security Council resolutions on North Korea. North Korea will receive relief only when it demonstrates verifiable and irreversible steps to denuclearization.
Ileana Johnson, in the final 8 days here before next Tuesday, what are you watching for with this summit between the U.S. and North Korea?
You know, the president's shift from when he began talking about this summit, I think in his mind he felt that a single summit could resolve all the issues. And the soundbite you played there with him saying, we may need two meetings, we may need three, no meetings may ever happen at all. That seems to me him listening to his advisors who are telling him there's a long road ahead. This may take several years, as previous negotiations have taken. So what I'm watching between now and the summit, which the president essentially departs for Thursday or Friday because he goes to the G7 and takes off for straight from the G7 is what his advisors are telling him, how his rhetoric shifts, and what he may be hearing from allies at the G7 summit. I think it's very significant that he's taking off straight from Canada at the G7, where he will be speaking with allies there. And in particular, I think Prime Minister Abe of Japan, his visit Thursday will be incredibly significant.
Ishan, what do you expect North Korea to give up, if anything? We heard Jim Mattis, U.S. Defense Secretary, in that clip saying North Korea will receive relief only if it demonstrates verifiable and irreversible steps to denuclearization.
Well, even those steps seem a bit unlikely at this point. People, when you talk to people within the administration, they're aware that this initial goal of the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula was a pipe dream, and that the North Koreans would never actually give up their weapons. What you can expect if this summit still goes through, of course, in 8 days, a lot can happen, especially with this administration. What you can expect is, you know, a certain amount of symbolic statements and steps, perhaps commitments to not conduct further testing. We already saw this big photo op where some journalists from the West were bussed into North Korea to see the implosion of a nuclear testing site. So this is part of that long track forward. Of course, it's really important to recognize that there's a long and very tortured history of diplomacy with North Korea that didn't just start with this administration, and that previous American presidents have long resisted the lure of a kind of summit with a North Korean leader, precisely because they were aware that these kinds of photo ops, these kinds of moments of high summitry, give the North Koreans a certain kind of legitimacy and validation that they've yet to have on the world stage. And now we have a president in the White House who also loves these photo ops and also derives a certain kind of symbolic value from them that perhaps previous American presidents would not have.
A listener from our website says, this Kim summit sounds potentially reckless to me. Two hotheads with two irreconcilable positions staring at each other face to face over a table in Singapore. Here's Isaac in Fairfax, Virginia. Hi, Isaac.
Hi, Jane. Since we are running out of time, one of my greatest disappointments is that President Trump is violating the Lee Graham Act. And he's exporting military equipment to a brutal dictator in Africa, Paul Biya. as committing a genocide on southern Cameroonians or Amazonians. So there's a genocide going on, and President Trump is not putting an eye on it, just like Bill Clinton didn't do in 84.
Let's stick with North Korea for just a second here, Isaac. As we go to break, Sahil, I mean, take us out here. It seems like Congress has largely stayed out of this back and forth, this seesaw, this summit. It's on again, off again. I'm sure many members have strong positions here. What are you watching?
Well, the president has actually won praise from some of his critics in Congress, including Democrats, most notably, for pursuing diplomacy and kind of stopping with the threats and the rhetoric and the tweeting that he was doing before and kind of attempting to sit down. But nobody I've talked to on Capitol Hill seems optimistic about where this is going. The million-dollar question here is, how do you get a regime that views its survival as predicated on its nuclear weapons to give them up? How do you make that worth their while? What is their end game? And is there any substantive preparation where the White House knows what it's willing to give up as well to get there? I don't see that strategy mapped out at all.
We are discussing what's to come this week in Washington and beyond. Do you head to the polls tomorrow? What are your issues? What are you looking at this week? Great panel. They're sticking with us. I see some more calls here on the screen. We'll get to you after the break. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Ever get to Friday, look back on the week, and say to yourself, what just happened? I'm Sam Sanders. Check out my podcast, It's Been a Minute, where every Friday we catch up on the news and the culture of the week and try to make sense of it all. Listen on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're looking ahead to the week in Washington and around the world this hour, and you can join the conversation. What's on your radar this week? Trade, the G7, primary elections, Congress back to work. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking this hour with Ishan Tharoor of The Washington Post, Ileana Johnson of Politico, and Sahil Kapoor of Bloomberg Politics. Here's Canada's Finance Minister Bill Moreau telling reporters during a news conference on Saturday that tariffs will be a top of mind at the G7 conference his country is hosting later this week.
What we're trying to communicate is that the six countries, not including the United States, are expressing our concern over the tariffs that the United States has put forward.
Ileana Johnson, you're traveling to Quebec for the G7 summit. What's the White House strategy going into this?
I think we've seen it, which is to I think the president is running it. He's got a lot of different voices in his ears, some urging him to pull back on these tariffs, some urging him to go in full force. We saw some of that back and forth with Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin saying the trade war is on pause, and then the president moving full speed ahead. It seems now that the president will go into the G7 summit full speed ahead, and we'll have to see if any of his bilateral meetings with American allies there cause him to reconsider.
Ishan, the other six members of the G7 have rebuked the Trump administration's trade actions, especially over the weekend. Is the U.S. a reliable partner to our traditional allies in the G7 anymore?
Well, you had the French finance minister even very provocatively saying that it's no longer the G7, it's the G6 plus one. And that's a pretty striking statement, because the G7, this block of Western European industrial nations, the biggest economies there, the U.S. and Canada, these like-minded democracies, is seen to be this kind of safe space for the West. You know, when you have a whole bunch of other blocks in the world, G20 and so on, where there's more conflict, this is supposed to be a grouping of like-minded Western democracies. And now you have a huge disruption to that, and it's not just about trade. Justin Trudeau, the Canadian Prime Minister, wanted to make this summit heavily about climate change as well. And of course, Trump sees the issue very differently than his counterparts in the G7.
G6 plus one, Sahil Kapoor. I mean, what are the broader implications here? Wow.
Well, it's an awkward summit for President Trump. I think he's been openly hostile to international institutions and, you know, international agreements that his predecessors have struck. Just in his first 500 days, he's pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, which most American allies supported. Europe is continuing with it. He's pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is controversial here domestically, but, you know, it certainly came as a shock to American allies. He's pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords, which really puts the U.S. on an island almost entirely by itself in the world. So, you know, the president has a balancing act here. He's got to make the case for why he thinks this is right, but he should not expect to you know, find a lot of approval on the international stage while he is openly attacking these sorts of institutions and these kinds of accords that have been made in the past.
Mm. I want to move on now to a big day tomorrow, big primary day tomorrow in many states, including California, Mississippi, Alabama, Iowa, Montana, New Jersey, New Mexico, South Dakota. Sahil, you've been covering this extensively. What are you watching for tomorrow?
The biggest thing is California. The California primaries matter more than any of the others, and the reason is California has this unique top two system that they call a jungle primary, where everybody's on the ballot regardless of party, and the top two vote-getters make it to the general election. California is critical to Democrats' prospect of taking back the House majority. There are seven Republican-held seats right now that Hillary Clinton won, which show the potential, you know, that Democrats have. Now, three of these seats, all of them in Southern California, face the prospect of two Republicans making it to the general election and essentially shutting Democrats out. And the reason is there's an abundance of enthusiasm on the left and the Democratic side, which has led to a clutter of candidates in these three races. One is the 39th district, which is vacated by the retiring Ed Royce in Orange County. The another is the 49th district, vacated by the retiring Daryl Issa in the San Diego area. Both these are veteran Republicans who are stepping down because their districts have moved strongly toward Democrats and their reelections were in peril. The other one is the 48th district, held by 15-term Republican Congressman Dana Rohrabacher. This is the one the Democrats are most afraid of getting locked out at. There are two credible Republicans, Rohrabacher and Scott Baugh, and the two Democratic candidates, Harley Ruda, Hans Kierstead, face a cluttered field. Other candidates, the party and progressive organizations are split between them. This is a huge fear for Democrats that they're going to squander their opportunity before they even get to the election in these seats.
Eliana Johnson, it sounds like Democrats have a real fight on their hands in many places. What's the president's strategy? Who's he getting behind in these races? And is his strategy different from the special elections we just saw when he was very vocal about the candidates he supported?
Yeah, the president has been more or less quiet. And I think it, particularly in California, you've seen much more concern from Democrats than Republicans. And Republicans want to stay quiet and really let Democrats clash in those seats and hope that out of all the noise on the Democratic side, Republicans manage to stay under the radar and emerge victorious.
So Ishan, put some of this into context for us. Based on what we saw internationally this past week in Spain and in Italy, you've drawn some comparisons to what Democrats could face here, some of what we've just been talking about.
Well, I think if you try to frame this, and obviously every country has very different politics, but if you try to frame this in a Western or global lens, at least for Europe and North America, what's clear, especially when you look at the Democratic primaries, is that there is a long-running crisis among center-left political parties or the traditional center-left establishment. And when you see what's happened to parties in Europe, the nature of their parliamentary systems have sped up the implosion of the traditional center-left parties in a way that you wouldn't see in the United States, of course. Mm-hmm. But you know, in Italy now you have a populist government with two, you know, one somewhat left-wing populist party in coalition with a very right-wing populist party. Both parties have siphoned off support from their more sort of centrist traditional counterparts on the left and right. In Spain, you have a very unwieldy, a very fragile coalition government there that is in its last throes. I mean, the socialists have a minority government, and they're seeing their support bleed to the left and to new sort of upstart parties on the center right as well.
Let me play this clip because elections tomorrow, midterms will be here before you know it. And this was a wide ranging interview with former White House advisor Steve Bannon this weekend. CNN's Fareed Zakaria asked him about what's at stake in this year's midterm elections.
November 6th of 2018, it's going to be a base plus election. OK, and if you want to limit, and by the way, it's up or down vote on impeachment. Trump is on the ballot in every congressional district. This is not going to be some Democratic congressman versus Republican congressman. This is going to be Donald Trump versus Nancy Pelosi and Tom Steyer.
And he's nationalizing it using immigration.
At one of the, you're going to see more of this. You're going to see more of the central beating heart issues. Immigration is definitely going to be one.
Donald Trump versus Nancy Pelosi. Let's get Dave in here from Iowa. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. The elections are important tomorrow, and the reason why, especially for us Republicans, is that the Republican Party has been co-opted by industry, especially the example of the new farm bill. The middle-class farmer right now is in big trouble. These farm bills have been putting us out of business. We need new people to come into the Republican Party who aren't already co-opted by these big industries like Farm Bureau, like all the big grain outlets that like the overproduction scheme mm-hmm. that the farm bills are mm-hmm. giving us. So, you know, there's a congressman here in Iowa that's trying to support us in an attempt to get a savings account for farmer that's connected to unsubsidized crop insurance that doesn't cost the taxpayer near as much money and gets this economy more back to a more real thing. Politico had a great ad or a great article on why 12 major conservative groups were against this last farm bill because of the distortion of the free market. And we have to end this stuff, and the Republicans are the biggest problem with that right now.
Dave, thank you. I'm glad you called and bring us to the farm bill. Sahil, tell us about that. Congress back. Could they tackle the farm bill again?
Well, that is something that the House would like to bring back after there was an embarrassing failure a few weeks ago of the farm bill due to divisions within the conference on immigration. That to me, is one of the key things to watch as Congress returns. This negotiation going on between the hardline kind of anti-immigration factions and the moderates who are pushing this fix to the DACA program that President Obama created and that President Trump has called to an end. They have set a soft deadline of June 7th for a negotiation. And they seem to have the votes through this discharge petition, having teamed up with Democrats to force a vote to go around Speaker Ryan and you know, get the House to vote on this. Along with that, you're going to see the Senate confirming more judges. This is Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader's top priority. The Congress has to tackle government funding by the end of September to prevent another shutdown, which, you know, President Trump has toyed with, you know, forcing a shutdown if there's no wall funding, so we could see another battle there. Those are the big issues, I think, to watch for when Congress returns.
Ileana, what about immigration? Republican leaders plan a special meeting this week. Speaker Paul Ryan making a last-ditch effort to stop moderates from forcing votes on immigration proposals, specifically DACA. What's ahead on this issue?
It's so interesting because I think there's nothing more that Paul Ryan would like as a legacy item as speaker than to do DACA. But he's the one who's been pumping the brakes on this petition that would advance DACA in the House. And that is going to come to a head this week. And Paul Ryan's argument has been we cannot push forward an argument that the president would veto. And the problem with this all along has been a lack of clarity from the White House on what would be acceptable to the president. So we have a group of moderates in the House who really want to push DACA through. They believe it would get through the Senate. And the real block here seems to be that the president would not sign a sort of moderate immigration bill that would solve the DACA problem. And Ryan's argument has been that he doesn't want to get it to that point.
Let me play this clip. President Trump, during his weekly address on Saturday, blasting congressional Democrats for blocking confirmation of his nominees and for their stance on immigration and border security.
Democrats in Congress are also blocking urgently needed improvements to our border security. They don't want border security for two reasons. Number one, they don't care about it. Number two, they're afraid it's going to make me and the Republicans look good. And they don't want that.
Sahil, a last-ditch agreement on immigration, do you think?
Highly unlikely at this point. I think the red line that President Trump has laid out that keeps scuttling these agreements to do something about DACA and even the wall is cuts to legal immigration, cuts to family sponsorships of siblings and parents and adult children, which American citizens are currently allowed to do. The president wants to eliminate that. He also wants to eliminate the diversity visa lottery. Democrats have caved on the wall. They're willing to give him $25 billion for that, but they're not willing to give on legal immigration cuts. So I don't see that. I don't see that circle being squared, at least before the November elections. It's very interesting, though, to see the president talk about immigration, to focus on MS-13 so much, the gangs, and to kind of portray, people flooding the southern border and overwhelming the United States. He wants the midterm election to be about this because he knows this is what excites the Republican base. This is no longer, a party that is primarily motivated by fiscal issues like the proper level of taxation and the size of government. These cultural issues, these nativist issues are much more powerful.
And if I could add one thing, I think that was Trump's genius of tapping into that, because for decades, Republicans thought that their voters were motivated by fiscal issues. And Trump came along and I think blew up that conventional wisdom.
I think that's exactly right.
All right. We'll keep watching that. Just a couple of minutes left here. Sean, I wanted you to jump back in here because just before this potential summit with North Korea, North Korea's state news agency reports that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad plans to make a state visit to North Korea. No date announced as of yet. Sean, does this have the potential to destabilize, add a wrinkle to the Singapore summit between Trump and Kim?
I don't really think so. We don't know exactly when or if this visit will actually happen and when that would be. What it came out of was Assad taking the credentials of a new North Korean ambassador in Damascus and then suggesting that he would come visit. Of course, if he does visit, it would be very striking. It would be the first time any foreign leader has visited Kim Jong-un since he came to power. And I mean, at the same time, Syria and North Korea do have a history, a long Cold War history of relations, and the North Koreans have played some sort of role in arming the Syrians and building up Syria's chemical weapons program. So there are real links there. I don't think, while it is a very fascinating, somewhat disturbing geopolitical wrinkle, I don't think it could necessarily be the reason that Trump pulls out of the summit at this point.
And speaking of summits, the White House appears to be planning for a potential summit between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. No date, no location announced as of yet. Eliana, in the midst of the Russia probe, the ongoing Mueller investigation, what do you make of all that?
I don't make too much of it because I would just need to point you to all of the back and forth, the we're in, we're out on this North Korea summit. So I think this is very, very preliminary, excuse me, in terms of planning for a Russia summit. And I think we need to see a lot more in terms of the planning before we get too spun around the axle about Trump and Putin sitting down at the White House or anywhere else.
Well, thank you. Terrific panel and a lot to discuss, a lot coming up. And we got to it today. Thank you very much. Eliana Johnson from Politico. Always glad to have you.
Thanks, Jane.
Ishan Tharoor of The Washington Post. I appreciate you being here, Ishan. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Sahil Kapoor of Bloomberg Politics. Thanks so much, Sahil.
Thank you, Jane.
Listeners, continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.